Hello, Wayne. Happy December 1st. It is another episode of Good Heavens.
Good Heavens. We're at it again.
Well, let's give it a whirl.
Let's go.
We're going to be talking today about a little bit about Pluto, right? A little bit.
It's in the neighborhood of where we're going.
It's in the neighborhood. Yeah, so we're going to get a little bit about Pluto. We got some interesting stuff about Jupiter and how the outer part of our solar system came together. What do you call that theory?
Yeah, it's a new theory on the how the outer planets got into their places, basically, called the Nice model, named after the city of Nice, France.
Okay, so when we talk the outer planets, we're talking the gas giants.
Right? Yeah, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and
Neptune.
And Neptune.
Yes.
Pluto is out there, we'll mention it a little, but it's mostly about the four gas giant planets.
Yes, and Pluto is, so far as we know, is not mostly gas. It's a rocky.
No, it's ice. Various
it's ice.
Flavors of ice.
So it's like a snow cone.
But it gives off nitrogen, and there's a lot of interesting things about Pluto.
Very cool. That's another episode in and of itself, is Pluto.
Yeah, we want to do Pluto.
So we're going to talk about the Nice model, not to be confused with your nieces, but the city in France.
Yeah, and I might slip and call it the Nice model.
Nice model.
I don't think it's a Nice model, but there's a lot of scientists who think it's a Nice model.
Okay, and why is it named after the city in France again?
There's a group of scientists who went to Nice, France, to put together the idea and work on the model.
And do you find it to be a satisfying explanation as far as we know?
Not to me, but
no?
it's fascinating science. So if you're interested in what's new, this is an interesting thing.
Okay, so that does bring up a point about basically the whole underlying aspect of our discussion. Is when we talk about the universe, we're talking about model building.
Yes.
Right? So nobody was around when all of this stuff came together.
Mm-hmm.
So we are extrapolating backwards from the physical data that's out there. We look at the gas giants. We look at the movement of the planets. We look at our solar system, and we build a model.
That's right. And since we can't go back in time and watch it and take a video of it, Dan, what we do instead is we put it on a computer and then let a computer run it out and see what a computer can do with it.
Right. And what's always interesting to me about computer models, Wayne, is that a scientist will come back and say, oh, the computer models suggest that it's possible that the universe or the stars or the solar system or planets can form without divine intervention. But I think when a cosmologist or an astronomer and an astrophysicist uses a computer to show how the universe unfolded, to me, all it does is demonstrate that you need the input of sentient intelligence to run a model, to build a solar system, to build a universe.
Yes, I agree. But, putting the physics and the science of it into a computer, scientists have to make a lot of simplifying assumptions.
Right, right.
That can't really be proven.
Yeah,
And sometimes they make assumptions that are really not like a real system.
Yeah, they have to. In other words, in order to make a model, you front load a model with certain assumptions you take for granted.
That's right.
Right. So when we talk about models of anything in science, they're partially built on observation, partly built on theoretical speculation. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
But that's just kind of how models are. They're not 100% purely empirical.
Right.
A lot of it is speculative. A lot of it is guesswork, good guesswork, but it's not always pure science, as we would like to say,
empirical science. It really is not empirical at all. It's theoretical.
Yeah.
And it can give insight about cause and effect.
Yeah.
If you change this, it causes this.
Right.
But there's always a limit to what we know, and when we run it out on a computer, that does not... That is not evidence that something really happened that way.
Right.
To put together evidence that it really happened that way is a whole different question.
It's a
computer model being able to run it and show it doesn't prove that anything happened.
Yeah, right. So we're not criticizing that. We're just pointing out that models of any part of the cosmos in science are front-loaded with assumptions. And that's okay. We're just noting the speculation aspect of model building. And so that brings us to our underlying theoretical or theological point of our broadcast, is that when we do science, Wayne, who is doing science? It's not birds and deer and chickens that are doing science. It's human beings.
Human beings.
And right. we are theologically speaking, fallible and more oftentimes foolish than wise.
Yes.
We are sinful. We are fallen. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, we see through a glass darkly or paradoxically. Either our vision is dim or our vision is obscured in some way. When we look at things, through our own limited perspectives.
And so, that's right. And I like what someone said, Dan, that everyone is ignorant just on different things.
That's true of me. That's true of you.
I think that's so true.
Right.
Even smart people who are absolute geniuses in certain areas are often very ignorant about certain
other
things.
Absolutely, yeah. Like
it kind of balances their genius with the rest of their life in some way.
Einstein played the violin and figured out relativity, but he his socks didn't often match, I understand.
Yeah.
I don't clean up my house very well. I have laundry that befuddles me. But you have a quote that I want you to read from Scripture, and I have a couple other things we'll read, and then we'll get into the Nice model.
Okay. So this is from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Dan, and it's kind of interesting to think about human knowledge and science in relation to this. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 19, it starts with a quote of Isaiah 29, and it says, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate." That is a quote from Isaiah, and I'm going to go on with a little more from this. This is back to the Apostle Paul again. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world, through its wisdom, did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe.
The wisdom of God, the foolishness of God, is wiser than man.
That's right.
And
that's another verse. I could go on to that. That's just a couple of verses later.
And
the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength.
Right. So that what appears to us as foolishness is actually divine wisdom, sort of incognito.
Right.
Paradoxic, dark, an enigma, a mystery.
So the path to wisdom and insight is not what we naturally expect it to be.
No.
It's actually through what seems to the natural person to be foolishness.
Yeah.
But it's not foolishness because it really leads to real insight.
I have a quick quote here from an Anglican priest by the name of Myron Penner. He's quoting the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard. And Penner says this, I think these are Kierkegaard's words, but he's quoting them anyway. Whether it's Penner or Kierkegaard saying this, the quote is still pretty apt to what we're talking about. Speaking of Jesus coming in the flesh, he says that the incarnation in which God becomes a human, Jesus of Nazareth, is the founding event of Christianity and the central proclamation of its revelation. God, who is transcendent and eternal and omnipotent, the creator of the universe, appears inside the creation as a part of it. The truly remarkable and supernatural aspect of this is that God can undergo this incognito as a particular man, Jesus, and be unrecognizable to the natural eye. That is, as I see it, what provides Christianity a central insight into the basic structure of human reason and its relation to the world. In a world of incarnation, truth can only appear to reason as a paradox, that is to say, indirectly, since the incarnation of God involves a juxtaposition of such paradoxical elements as eternity inside time and the infinite in the finite. It is not a truth that can appear to us directly. The upshot of the incarnation is that we now see God as fully here in ordinary life in a way that runs contrary to our natural expectations or what our rational deliberations demand. In other words, Jesus comes in the flesh and befuddles our wisdom. This is not how we could expect. How could a timeless being be in a body bound by time? How can an eternal creator outside of the universe enter it and become part of it? That's the paradox and the mystery. The light that shines in the darkness, as John says, and the darkness did not comprehend or overcome it.
Yeah, there's a song, Dan, about Jesus and his becoming a baby, God becoming a baby, basically.
Yes.
That how could it's, I can't put it in the words of the song. I don't remember exactly, but it's how could the one who's the hands who stretched out the heavens have such tiny little hands and fingers?
Yeah. How could the creator of the universe be the
how could the creator be a little baby?
How can the architect of Andromeda lay in a bed of straw as an infant? And there's a another passage that I like in Acts 4:13, after the disciples had been talking to the religious leaders. The religious leaders were marveling, for they understood the disciples to be uneducated and untrained men. Now, it's interesting, the Greek, uneducated and untrained, the word for untrained is idiotai. Does that sound familiar? It is from the word, it is the word from which we get idiot. And so it is true that, and one atheist that I know, his name's Richard Carrier, he has a book called Why I'm Not a Christian, and I had to read that recently. And in the book, Carrier says this, he says, if God wants something from me, he would tell me. He wouldn't leave something else or someone else to do this. And he would certainly not leave fallible, sinful human beings to deliver an endless plethora of confused and contradictory messages. So Carrier thinks that the messages are confused, but he's sure that if God would send a message to him, he wouldn't do so through idiots. But that's exactly what God does. He sends his message through idiotai.
Yeah.
You, me, everybody. I mean, in the sight of God, we are foolish, unlearned, untrained, as Paul says to the Corinthians. Not many of you are wise, right? And I think that's the lot of all of us, whether we are believers or unbelievers, scientists or non-scientists. We all fall under the category of idioti. But
right.
God entrusts his message to us. I mean, if you look in the scriptures, you have David committing adultery, Samson, who was a lustful braggart. You had Solomon, who had many wives and concubines. Saul was a murderous Pharisee before he was Paul. And Peter cuts off the ear of the servant of the high priest.
Right.
And then denies Jesus three times.
Yes.
And then even the Christians in Corinth were a mess.
Yes.
The whole two letters to the Corinthian church was
full
because
of problems.
They
yeah.
were full of idioti.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Paul was very compassionate to them in his epistle. And I think when we talk about... So what does this have to do with science, Wayne? One more quote from Carl Sagan, and
okay.
then we'll move on to the Nice model.
Okay. So scientists... Dan, I think they are intelligent people, and I'm not saying they're not competent, but I would say that they make a lot of assumptions that they put a lot of trust in that are not always
right.
the only way of looking at things.
We're not picking on scientists. We are
right.
ourselves lumping ourselves into the finite, corrupted idioti. We're not condemning science and hoisting ourselves up as smarter than physicists or scientists or astrophysicists.
Right.
We're not doing that.
There's a degree where to which having a career kind of pressures you into a certain path
okay.
in what you do in science, and that's not always the way to find answers. People kind of camp out on certain ideas
yeah.
and they don't consider other options
yeah.
enough.
I found this from, I've shared this with you before, but I'll share it with our audience here. I found this quote from Carl Sagan's book, The Demon-Haunted World,
yeah.
Science as a Candle in the Dark, and I love what he says here. I this is one of those things where I can agree with Sagan. He says,
mm-hmm.
quote, I think that all social turmoil and human weakness aids in the enterprise of science.
Mm.
It might be useful, he says, for scientists now and again to list some of their mistakes. It might play an instructive role illuminating and demythologizing the process of science and in enlightening younger scientists. Sagan notes that even Johannes Kepler, Isaac Newton, Charles Darwin, Gregor Mendel, and Albert Einstein made serious mistakes. But the scientific community arranges all things so that teamwork prevails.
Yes.
What one of us, even the most brilliant among us, misses, another of us, even someone much less celebrated and capable, may detect and rectify. I don't think that you could have said anything better about the church.
That's a wonderful point.
It is. Whether you're a scientist or a Christian, I think what Sagan says there is true about science. It's true about any human endeavor, that any times there are human beings involved, there will be mistakes. But it is what Sagan said. Look, if mistakes can be made in science and progress can be made from those mistakes, then great. I think this is a great paradigm for a great description of the church. So we're not picking on scientists or theologians or cosmologists. We're saying we're all in the same boat, you know. There is no, we're not exalting our superiority. We're not saying we know everything. We're simply saying that we know in part, and we progress and try to build models based on the best knowledge that we have,
right,
and we go forward with that. And the Nice model, we now get to our Nice model. The Nice model is one of those proposals. What do you think? So
right,
lay it on us, Wayne. What's
okay,
the Nice model?
So, well, in our last podcast, Dan, we talked about another new model which is related to this. It's called the Grand Tack model, and that has to do with the inner planets, and especially Jupiter and Saturn. So in the Grand Tack, just to review what we did a little before, in the Grand Tack has Jupiter and Saturn migrate inward close to the Sun, or near, let's say, near Earth orbit. And then they turn around. They stop and turn around. They sort of lock into a resonance together, and they move together outward. So when the Grand Tack is over, Jupiter is just about at its correct place and position, but Saturn is not yet as far away from the Sun as it is now. So the Grand Tack, when the Grand Tack ends, that sets up the beginning of the Nice model.
Okay.
So the Nice model, although it was actually put together first, but the Nice model starts with Jupiter pretty much in place, and it pretty much stays there. Saturn migrates outward, and Uranus and Neptune also migrate outward. So Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune become sort of locked in position together, and they migrate together. So in this idea, okay, see, Jupiter and Saturn migrated inward and outward because of gas. But in the Nice model, the gas is all gone. So what's left in the solar system is small rocky objects, what they call planetesimals. They're like asteroids. And there is the planets come into a resonance relationship. So a resonance is a timing relationship. So Saturn and Uranus may get into a resonance, like a 1-2 resonance or a 3-4 resonance. That's how their orbital periods relate to each other. So when they get into a resonance, then one of them affects the other a lot. The reason they could migrate is because they start closer together than they are now. So in the Nice model, the planets are not as far away from the Sun as they are today in the real system. They start closer together. This makes them able to affect each other in these resonances. And their orbits are not perfect circles. If two planets are in perfect circular orbits and they're in a resonance, that's probably going to be a very stable thing.
Yeah.
But if their orbits are a little bit elliptical, just a little bit stretched out, then they tend to pull on each other.
Mm.
So the Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune become in these resonant relationships. They're just a little bit elliptical in their orbits, so they're tugging on each other. And out in the region where Neptune is going, out in the outer solar system, there is a huge belt of lots and lots and lots of rocks.
So
planetesimals.
This is part of the theory. This is an early in our solar system. Jupiter, to summarize, Jupiter and Saturn are moving outward from the Sun, and beyond Jupiter and Saturn is this alleged field of rocks.
Right.
Okay.
So now there are really objects out there.
There are.
By Neptune.
Yes.
And they're usually, today they're called trans-Neptune
objects. Trans-Neptunian objects?
TNOs.
TNOs, yeah.
The old term for them was Kuiper Belt objects. But,
okay.
But the new term that they're using now is trans-Neptune object, or TNO. Well, those objects today that we really know of, that really exist, they are relatively few and far between in comparison to what this theory is. So the NICE model says that there was once much, much more of these objects out there.
Okay.
And they say that at that time in the model, they say it was enough to add up to 35 times the mass of the Earth.
Wow.
Spread out in these rocks.
Okay.
In the outer solar system. So it's the fact that you have this big belt of lots and lots of rocks in the outer solar system, and you have the planets in these orbits that kind of tug on each other, and so this is what makes the outer planets migrate out.
Is the tug of the mass of this debris.
Right.
Okay, but now they're saying at one time there was a lot more.
Yes.
And the mass of these things was pulling the outer gas giants, pulling Saturn and Jupiter, out in their direction.
Right. So one of the things they say is evidence of this is the way these TNO objects now are arranged. So there's 200 or 300 of them that we know of that scientists really know their orbits for.
Now, let's just kind of briefly talk about, are these like asteroids? Are these like more like planets? What are they more like?
You can think of them as like asteroids, except they're probably more icy.
Okay.
Because it's cold out there, Dan.
Sure.
Yeah. So, and some of them have, like, organic material on them.
Okay.
Some could have frozen methane on them. Maybe.
But they can actually, we actually have telescopic pictures of TNOs?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, these are very faint and hard to see, but their scientists are looking for them all the time.
Sure.
And so these objects, the way we observe them now, some of them are kind of just randomly scattered out there.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are in particular positions that kind of lines up in resonance positions with Neptune.
Oh, okay.
So Neptune has apparently moved some of these objects around until they come into these stable positions in resonance with Neptune.
Okay. Now, are the, this might be a little, I don't mean to get too technical for our listeners, but would some of the resonance be equated to the Lagrange points of two orbiting bodies?
I think there are a few. There's, but Neptune doesn't have many Lagrange objects, I don't think.
Okay, so, but briefly, just, I don't mean to get into an aside, but Lagrange objects are points between two orbiting bodies, two masses, of gravitational equilibrium. So, like, between the Earth and the Moon, there are five Lagrange points, and those are where the gravity is equal, where you could technically balance something between the Earth and the Moon. Something
right.
Like,
yeah. They're kind of special positions. Either they line up with the Sun, or they're at 60-degree angles
yeah.
with the Sun. And
well, what's really cool is that a lot of our telescopes, I mean, you know this, but some of our best telescopes are at Lagrange points that exist between the Earth and the Sun. They're like little shelves where we've put some of the best telescopes we've had in the last couple of years, where we actually balance a telescope in a Lagrange point between the Earth and the Sun. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I think the Kepler telescope is
Kepler
close,
was there?
Close to one of the spots because it's a kind of stable position.
Yeah, the SOHO, the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, is at Lagrange Point 1 between the Earth and the Sun.
Uh-huh.
And the new James Webb that'll be up sometime
okay.
will be at Lagrange Point 2. And there are other, I think the Wilkinson microwave antenna was at Lagrange Point 2 as well. It's
okay.
just kind of cool that,
yeah.
that there are these little
right.
pockets of gravity where we can put something
that's
on
right.
the shelf to look at the rest
that's
of the
that's
universe.
That's right. It's great like, observation platform, if
yeah,
you will.
Did yeah. somebody know we were coming, you know?
Yeah, so take advantage of those things.
Absolutely, we do.
So
we're in.
So they're saying that these trans-Neptune objects, some of them were randomly scattered, and some of them are sort of like they're arranged in certain positions in resonance with Neptune. And so they are saying that the reason they got into these resonance positions is because Neptune migrated.
Okay.
So they believe that the migration of the planets would put the asteroid belt, kind of scatter objects into the asteroid belt. It would sort of move things around in the trans-Neptune area, and other things like the range points.
I have an image that might be helpful to our listeners here. I boil water when I make coffee in the morning, and sometimes when I pour water into a pan, there's some floaties in the water. And when you go to scoop out something in the water, you know, you try to scoop it out with your finger, what happens? That little floaty thing goes around, right? It's hard to pick something out of the water because it always goes to one side or the other as your finger's going through the water. And I think that's kind of what the planets are doing as they move through the mass of these objects. They sort of push them along into a certain direction.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
So a migrating planet would move objects with it. Small objects get pulled along with it or scattered by it. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you start with this big, thick, real dense zone of lots of rocks in the outer solar system.
Uh-huh.
Neptune and Uranus sort of do a do-si-do for a while, jostling for position, and then they eventually come into an arrangement where Neptune is the one that's farther away, and so they move outward. Neptune starts to plow into this zone of rocks.
Okay,
and when it does that, it scatters all the rocks everywhere.
Mm. So it had to come from somewhere.
Right.
And there, I'm assuming the Nice model builders take the gas giants to have formed from the protoplanetary disk of our sun, correct?
Yes.
They're just suggesting that in their early formation, after they formed, there was a lot of moving and shaking going on. They were definitely living up to their name of the planetai, or Greek for wanderers.
Wanderers. Yeah, in fact, that's a good point. Because one of the things they've explored is, what if there were more than four outer planets?
And so
one of the models, it's a variation on the Nice model. They called it Jumping Jupiter. So Jumping Jupiter is the idea that you had another extra planet that doesn't exist anymore, and it was between Jupiter and Uranus. I'm sorry, it's between Saturn and Uranus.
Saturn and Uranus.
So it gets into an elliptical orbit, and so that becomes unstable, and Jupiter ends up throwing it out of the solar system.
Wow.
So when that planet gets thrown out in the computer models, this makes the other outer planets kind of
lock in,
jump out. It sort of puts them in, spreads them out quickly.
Okay.
It puts them more into position a little easier. So one of the problems with the Nice model is actually that Neptune may not actually get out to its real position now. So these models are trying, Dan, to make the final result of the computer model this like the current solar system.
Yeah, what data has to go in the front in order to get the outcome we see.
Right.
Yeah, so they're extrapolating backwards and going, what if this, what if that, what if we put a massive planet here, what if we put some rocks here, what if we put a Jupiter here or Saturn here, and they go back and they put this into the computer and run it and see if they get something like what we have.
Right. Well, one of the problems that comes up is about moons, Dan. You know, the outer planets have a lot of moons.
Yes, they do.
And in the beginning of the Nice model, they were saying that the Nice model, the migration of Saturn, could help explain why Saturn has some moons that are kind of in elliptical orbits. They're not very circular orbits. But Saturn does have moons that do have circular orbits.
Yeah.
So the elliptical orbits are considered irregular. And the circular orbit moons are considered regular.
Now, I know with Jupiter, there's like 67, 68 moons.
Yeah.
Some of them go in line with the axial rotation of the planet.
Some of them go backwards.
The opposite way.
That's right.
So, and then Uranus has weird moon orbits because Uranus is basically a planet knocked on its side. The north pole of Uranus faces the sun, and the moons that Uranus has goes around the equator of Uranus as if Uranus was on its side. These moons follow around the axial rotation of Uranus.
Yeah, but you see, the moons of Uranus are actually regular, not irregular,
because
they are very circular, and they're all moving the same direction that Uranus is spinning.
But Uranus is spinning on its side.
That's right. That's so the whole thing is on.
The whole unit
so
as a package.
The moons are quirky just like Uranus.
Yeah, that's
okay?
it.
So this is a very significant thing because the moons of Uranus are very hard to explain from this migration.
Yeah, how would you knock all this on its side
if
like that?
If a planet starts to move, this makes, if the moons are not very close to the planet, they would probably get thrown
scattered
off into space
easily,
and it would lose them.
Yeah.
If they're closer to the planet, then the moon orbits would get stretched out.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't be circular orbits anymore.
It'd be elliptical.
So how do you have this perfect orderly arrangement with a planet on its side?
And circular orbits of moons.
I think this requires supernatural creation.
Well, and I think what
physics doesn't explain Uranus very well.
Right. And what I think the Nice model shows, a very simplistic summary of what the Nice model shows, is that sometimes, Wayne, a lot of times, when you go to great lengths to try to come up with a completely naturalistic scenario,
mm-hmm.
the assumptions that have to go in the front end seem to be, it doesn't mean they're not true, it just seems to be that they're really kind of requiring a stretch of the imagination that almost says, well, wait a minute, it's almost like we need to apply Occam's razor here. There's too many variables going into the front-loaded software of this program to create the situation that we see now. Right.
So at some point it just becomes unrealistic.
That's right. Now, it's interesting. I have a quote. I read this. We read this the other night in the Bible study from Stephen King, the horror novel author.
Okay.
He is in terms of an interview I saw with him in 2012 or 2013, he does believe in God. Now, I don't think that he would say he was a Christian, but he counted himself as a theist.
Okay.
But in 1999, he wrote a book. Or he was writing a book during the time he had his accident, or writing shortly after his accident that he almost got killed. He was hit by a driver on the side of a road. He has a book called On Writing, where he describes what it's like, the writing craft, what it's like to be a writer, how you have to go about writing. And what I want to read here, I think, kind of touches on exactly the way in which scientists, cosmologists, astronomers look at the universe, trying to derive a bigger picture. So as I'm reading this, obviously I'm reading how an author reads his own text, but I think it's also insightful in terms of how I think a lot of model-building scientists read the text of the universe. So King says, underneath, I am asking myself the big questions, the biggest. Is this story coherent? And if it is, what will turn coherence into a song? What are the recurring elements? Do they entwine and make a theme? I'm asking myself, what's it all about, Stevie, in other words, and what I can do to make those underlying concerns even clearer. What I want most of all is resonance, something that will linger for a while in the constant reader's mind and heart after he or she has closed the book and put it up on the shelf. I'm looking for ways to do that without spoon-feeding the reader or selling my birthright for a plot of message. So I think that's exactly kind of what cosmologists are trying to do when they build a model. What are the themes? How do I construct a narrative that resonates with people that when we look at it, we can go, yes, that makes sense, that's imaginative, but that also it touches my mind and my heart. And it's not just what we would call in philosophy ad hoc. You're not just making something up to fit the data. You're actually creating something that resonates with the readers. And so when we walk through the Nice model, we can ask ourselves this question. Does it resonate? Is it true? Does it make sense? Does it resonate with the mind and the heart? Or does this seem like an awfully long end around to try to explain our solar system without God?
So I think sometimes the scientists put a lot of effort into a model, but it to common people it sounds really weird,
beyond our ability. And sometimes, Wayne, and I don't say this about, I don't want to generalize about all scientists, but a lot of times when you discuss these things, the layman's lack of scientific knowledge is oftentimes wielded against the lay person. Well, what do you know about physics? What do you know about cosmology? What do you know about trigonometry? How do you know what do you know about Einstein or quantum mechanics? You know,
right? And the common people will be just kind of dismissed.
It's like when the priest used to read Latin in church and nobody understood Latin.
Right.
You know, they're like, well, okay, I heard something, but I'm not sure what I heard. It was Latin, and it came from the Bible, so. And in a lot of ways, I think the high language of science has taken on a sort of priestly connotations to where only the specialist can read and interpret and understand and disseminate what's going on.
Right.
And it's more important, I think, and I hope that's what our podcast is doing, to sort of bring out the human side of astronomy, right? That there are human beings that look at this and, just like Stephen King, look at the universe like a text and say, what's the best explanation?
Right. And, you know, Dan, we work at trying to explain these ideas and make it understandable. And that is an effort to communicate to people science in a way that doesn't go over everyone's head.
Yeah.
But if you explain it well, I think people can evaluate it. You shouldn't say that people who don't know much science cannot evaluate a new theory like that.
Right.
It just needs to be explained and presented right. And I think they really can evaluate it.
Absolutely.
And their opinion should be paid attention to.
Yeah. You as we came in this morning, you said you brought a hymnal, and you wanted to read something from one of your favorite hymns, one of mine too. How do you want to wrap this up?
Well, you know, I've studied the planets and the solar system a lot, Dan, and it makes me think of this, the first verse of the hymn, How Great Thou Art.
Yeah, I love that.
So that's what I wanted to read.
Go ahead.
And this is really beautiful to me. It starts out, O Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder consider all the worlds thy hands have made, I see the stars, I hear the rolling thunder, thy power throughout the universe displayed. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee, how great thou art, how great thou art.
That's exactly what, it's kind of what King says. Resonance that leads to a song.
Yes.
Right? When we contemplate creation and the resonance of the planets.
Maybe that's not the song Stephen King had in mind, but it's a good one.
But maybe that's not the resonance that the Nice model makers were thinking of. But,
well, maybe they should. That's right.
But yes, I think, you know, and the other thing, too, we got to keep in mind is a lot of times when you talk to, as I've talked to atheists and skeptics, they'll say that, oh, science has explained this. We don't need God as an explanation. But as I've said a few times before on our podcasts, it's like saying, well, how do you make espresso? Well, you could talk about the biology of coffee beans and the mechanics of an espresso machine. Perfectly legitimate explanations. But that doesn't do away with the barista who makes the coffee.
Right, yes.
The barista is a legitimate explanation for why you have coffee in your cup. Mm-hmm. And so is the machine, and so is the biology of coffee.
Yeah, somebody made the coffee because they were nice enough to do that for
right.
us.
Right. And so the next time someone tells you that our sun is an ordinary star, you can say, oh, no. No, no, no. It's the only star that we know of in the universe that has a little rock going around it with coffee and baristas on it.
That's right. And it's the only planet we know where people make podcasts.
Idiotes that make podcasts.
That's right.
You and I both are idiots drinking coffee and making podcasts. That's great. But that's what I think astronomy should be. It should be brought down more for the layman to enjoy and explore and to resonate. And that's what the heavens were for, to resonate with us. The glory of God, as you express.
Right.
All right, Wayne, it's been great. Thank you for this wonderful episode of Good Heavens, and we will see you next time.
On Good Heavens.